to get up to the rep. But the other way required the Vanderbeeker kids to use the ladder directly across from the Biedermann's door. They had never used that roof entrance, for obvious reasons. "Be careful," Isa reminded them. She said that same thing in her listen-to-me-or-else tone every time they went to the roof. First, Isa and Lainey passed Miss Josie and Mr. Jeet's living room. "Hi, Miss Josie," Lainey chirped, tapping the window and waving when Miss Josie looked up from her television show. Next, they crept past the Biedermann's windows, which were covered by blackout curtains. Finally, they emerged onto the roof. The roof floor was not the typical concrete, sandpapery surface that covered most roofs in New York City. Right before the Vanderbeekers arrived, the 100-year-old roof was replaced and then topped off with current-colored ceramic tiles. The tiles made the rooftop welcoming and soundproof. Nevertheless, the kids knew to tread in the same manner they did when visiting one another's bedrooms late at night, being careful not to wake their parents. They were certain the Biedermann could not hear them, because he would definitely have said something about it. And not in a nice way, either. "Water wall to launch, with your permission," Jessie said to Isa when she got to the roof, lifting the water bottle out of the rep bag and holding it up. The sky glowed a Persian blue, and the black silhouettes of the buildings gave the neighborhood a fantasy quality, like the chimney sweep scene in the Mary Poppins movie. "Go for it, boss," Isa replied, taking the rep bag from Jessie and setting the blankets out on the ground. Jessie had built the water wall along the eastern facade of the brownstone, inspired by a science class during which her teacher showed them different cartoons of Rube Goldberg machines. The one Jessie loved the most was the cartoon demonstrating a sheet music turner. A guy who looked like a young Beethoven was sitting at a music stand where he was pumping a foot pedal that set off a bunch of reactions, like starting a bike pump that pumped air into a boxing glove, that punched a lever that caused a stick to shoot out, and turned the page on the music stand. This comic gave Jessie an excellent idea for something to make for Isa, and when she couldn't get the sheet music turner to work, she created the water wall instead. It ended up being a present for Isa's 12th birthday, and Jessie had spent nearly all of June working on it. Jessie brought her water bottle over to the east side of the brownstone, where an industrial metal funnel rested on the roof ledge. Jessie carefully positioned the water bottle in the wire cage, aimed the spout into the base of the funnel, then unscrewed the bottle cap. The water flowed into the funnel, where it descended through a black hose and settled into a metal container secured to the edge of the building. It then trickled along chutes that zigzagged along the side of the building, causing a series of water wheels with spokes to ping three sets of miniature wind chimes as they rotated. Next, the water set off a lever attached to a wooden rain stick, nudging the rain stick to sway back and forth like a lazy seesaw. The water then came to a drop-off, where it waterfalled one story down to a rounded piece of tin that Jessie had found on the curb coming home from school one day. The tin was magic. It vibrated and produced a different sound depending on what angle the water hit it. Then the water rolled off right into Mama's herb garden and kept the plants hydrated during the growing season, which was probably the only reason she had let Jessie construct the water wall in the first place. A 2-liter bottle of water was enough to keep the water wall's music going for about 15 minutes. The sound from the water wall was what Isa imagined a wind quartet would sound like if the musicians played on a grassy field on a rainy day, with umbrellas to protect the instruments, of course. Isa had been speechless when Jessie unveiled it on their birthday. Jessie had shrugged and said, "It's just physics, no big deal." The music was loud enough for the Vanderbeekers to hear from the roof, but quiet enough not to penetrate the Biedermann's soundproof windows. With the water wall singing, The Vanderbeekers gathered at the south side of the brownstone, leaning their elbows along the ledge, except Lainey, who could only rest her fingertips on the ledge and had to be picked up by Issa so she could see over the wall. The south view was the best. From there, they could see the rows of buildings up and down the block. In the distance, City College was lit up on the hill, looking like an ancient castle, complete with turrets.
"Let's play listen without paying attention," suggested Lainey.
This was one of her favorite games. She had made it up herself, and it didn't make sense to the rest of the kids until they were in the middle of the game. Then it made perfect sense.
"Close your eyes," instructed Lainey.
A few moments later, Hyacinth heard the sounds of merengue music coming from one of the apartments down the block. Oliver heard a sliding door opening and their next-door neighbor click a lighter for a cigarette. Jesse heard unrestrained laughter from a group of people walking down the street on the other side of the building. Issa heard the rainstick's pebbles shift back and forth on the water wall. Lainey, whose eyes were squeezed as tight as she could squeeze them, tried not to hear anything. Still, she heard Miss Josie's rich voice singing a gospel tune. It was amazing what the Vanderbeekers could hear when they weren't trying to listen to anything. Hyacinth's voice interrupted the not listening.
"Do you think we'll really stay in Harlem?"
"Of course," scoffed Jessie, opening her eyes. "Papa said so." Hyacinth shook her head.
"You know, he never really said we'd stay. And he looked sort of weird when he was talking about it. He had that same look he gets when he tells Grandma he loves that yucky anchovy casserole she always makes when she comes here."
"Papa has lived here all his life," Oliver said. "He's like the mayor of our block. He'd never leave."
"And his computer repair job is here," Jesse pointed out.
"He said he would hire me as his assistant when I turn 16.
Jesse paused for a nanosecond.
"Only 1,257 days to go."
"Papa doesn't lie," Lainey said. "Lying is bad news."
"I agree, Lainey," Issa looked out at the neighborhood. "This is my favorite view ever," she said.
"Do you think the Biedermann worked at the castle?"
Hyacinth asked, looking at City College.
"I thought only nice people were allowed to work in the castle."
"Princesses lived there,"
Lainey stated, bracing her arms on Issa's shoulders so she could get a better view.
"Princesses do not live there," Oliver said. "That's a college dummy."
"Don't call your sister dummy,"
Hyacinth and Issa said in unison.
"Come on," Issa said. "We have work to do."
She led her siblings to the blankets, where they sat down for the second meeting of Operation Biedermann. Hyacinth handed out the buttons she'd made, and her siblings attached them to their hoodies.
"Remember, not a word to Mama and Papa," Jesse reminded them.
The Vanderbeeker kids formed a tight circle and did a communal fist bump.
"What if we fail?" asked Hyacinth.
"We won't," Oliver said, pulling out a startlingly realistic pirate sword that was attached to a belt loop on his jeans and lifting it high in the air. "My idea is for all of us to get swords."
"So I've been thinking," Issa interrupted, "that the key to winning the Biedermann over is to play to our strengths."
"Good thing I have so many fine qualities to show off to the Biedermann,"
Oliver boasted.
"Who wants to share their ideas first?" asked Issa.
"Hyacinth should do the first Biedermann mission," Jesse said. "She's the craftiest person in the world."
Hyacinth froze, then shook her head in short, quick bursts.
"Come on, Hyacinth. You're the perfect person to go first. Not too overwhelming."
Here, Jesse shot a glance at Lainey, who was busy drawing hearts on everyone's hands with a felt-tip pen she had found in the rep bag.
"And not too obnoxious." Here, Jesse glared at Oliver, who was trying to untie Issa's sneakers with the tip of his sword.
Hyacinth the Brave could totally do it, Issa suggested.
Hyacinth continued to shake her hand.
Since Hyacinth is out,
Issa said, surveying her siblings, Jesse, you better go first.
Why not you? Said Jesse.
Because of our musical disagreements, replied Issa. Her siblings knew it was true. They all thought it was a shame the Biedermann reacted so strongly to stringed instruments, especially given Issa's extraordinary progress over the last 6 years. She had left the scary, screechy phase of violin playing shortly after that first year, and had even won a couple of violin competitions recently. Jesse sighed.
Fine. Send me to my doom, but someone's coming with me.
I'll help. I'll do it,
Lainey yelled, waving an arm in the air.
Shh, said Issa, Jesse, and Hyacinth.
I'll help, too, Oliver said.
Jesse looked over the two candidates.
Okay, Lainey, you're in.
Hey, what about me? Oliver said.
You're a little... Jesse began.
What? Demanded Oliver.
Unpredictable, suggested Issa.
Volatile, added Jesse. Hyacinth didn't say anything, but she gazed at Oliver adoringly.
I'm not that bad, said Oliver.
No, you're not, for a boy, but you could use some finesse, said Jesse.
Finesse, grumbled Oliver. I have so much finesse, you don't even know.
The water wall had long stopped singing, and the sky had darkened to an endless black by the time the kids were finished bouncing ideas back and forth. It turned out that Oliver did have the best idea for the first Operation Biedermann. However, even Oliver ultimately agreed that he was not the best delivery person. In addition to the baseball and sprinkler incidents, Oliver felt the Biedermann had a particular dislike for him because he used to practice dribbling on the sidewalk in front of the brownstone. This bothered no one in the entire neighborhood, unless your name was Biedermann.
Good idea, Oliver,
Issa said as she packed up the rep back. I think this is going to work.
See?
Oliver said over his shoulder. He swaggered back to the fire escape, his pirate sword swinging from his belt loop.
I told you I got finesse.
Saturday, December 21st. Chapter 5. The radiator woke Hyacinth the next day, whistling a joyful good morning. Instead of feeling cheered by it like she usually did, Hyacinth felt as if sewing needles were poking around in her stomach. It was Saturday, the official start to Operation Biedermann. Through her window, she could see the last wrinkled leaves gripping the branches of the ancient red maple, refusing to drift down to the ground until absolutely necessary. Hyacinth could tell Lainey was still in a deep sleep without even looking at her. Lainey made a funny whistling sound when she slept. Hyacinth climbed down from her bunk, shoved her feet into her bear slippers, and tugged on her favorite fuzzy sweatshirt, which she had stolen from Oliver. She stepped over a snoozing Franz and crept out the door, careful to turn the doorknob in that special way to keep it from squeaking. Despite being second to last in the Vanderbeeker family line, Hyacinth often felt she was the true middle child. Of course, Oliver had earned that right by being born between two sets of sisters, but he had the honor of being the only boy, which held him apart. The twins were exactly the same age, so in Hyacinth's mind, they sort of counted as one. If you didn't include Oliver because he was a boy, that left Hyacinth taking the true middle spot, fending for herself in a household of loud, strong-willed, attention-grabbing siblings. To get her fair share of time with her parents, Hyacinth had developed the habit of getting up early. She tiptoed downstairs.
Her dad was sitting on the couch, cradling his mug of steaming coffee, a thick book opened before him. Paganini was hopping in bizarre patterns around the living room carpet, periodically flinging himself into the air and spinning as if auditioning for a Broadway show. George Washington lay sprawled on his back, lazily swatting the bunny as he zipped past. Hyacinth stepped around the animals and snuggled in next to her dad. He slipped his arm around her, drawing her close. He smelled like coffee and peppermint drops.
"Papa, why does the Biederman hate us so much?"
Hyacinth asked. Papa kissed the top of Hyacinth's head.
"Hate is such a strong word. I definitely don't think he hates you. I think he's unhappy, which has nothing to do with you kids."
Hyacinth thought about the Biederman mission they had planned for that morning and was glad they were going to do something so nice for him. Then she felt ashamed that she was too afraid to do the first mission, even though all her siblings wanted her to.
"Papa," asked Hyacinth.
"Yes?"
"How can I get more brave?"
Hyacinth squeezed her eyes shut and curled in nearer to Papa. She was afraid he would tell her she would never be brave.
"Why, Hyacinth, you're one of the bravest people I know," Papa said.
"Really?"
asked Hyacinth, her eyes popping open.
"Really," said Papa. "It takes a super brave person to be as generous as you are, Hyacinth. Not many people are brave enough to be so loving."
Hyacinth thought about this while she watched Paganini nibble on a stack of books and George Washington groom his ears. Papa smiled at the animals.
"Until one is loved an animal, a part of one's soul remains unawakened."
Hyacinth looked up at her father.
"What does that mean, Papa?"
"It means that animals make our hearts happy in a very special way. A Frenchman named Anatole France said that a long time ago."
The sound of a door opening, then another one, marked the end of Papa and Hyacinth's morning alone time. A faucet turned on in the upstairs bathroom, and they heard water whooshed through the pipes within the brownstone walls. A big thunk followed, which was most likely Oliver jumping off the last few ladder rungs of his loft bed. Soft footsteps padded down the upstairs hallway and paused at the top of the stairs. Lainey was awake. She descended one step at a time, the stairs creaking happily. When she got to the bottom, she speed-walked to Papa, climbed into his lap, and nuzzled in close. And there they sat for a precious few minutes, Papa and his two youngest children, while the rest of the family awoke and the sounds of the city began its crescendo all around them. 10 minutes later, the Vanderbeeker apartment buzzed with kids and parents going in and out of bedrooms and bathrooms and up and down the stairs. When Issa came downstairs, she saw Oliver, his hair rumpled on one side, sitting slouched on a stool by the kitchen island, staring at an open book. She pulled out the stool across from him and sat down.
"Do you really think we can win the Biederman over in 4 days?
She asked as she gathered her hair back and braided it in a long plait. Oliver spoke without looking away from his book.
"Sure. Why don't we solve America's budget crisis and save the orcas while we're at it?"
Issa paused.
"So, that's a no?"
"Honestly," Oliver said, "I have no idea."
"I think your idea was brilliant."
"Really?"
Oliver perked up a bit.
"Oh, yeah," Issa replied. "I have a good feeling about it."
"Then you should hear my other idea," said Oliver, closing his book. "I think we should use a combination of Lainey, Hyacinth, and Jesse. First, Jesse can pick the lock to the Biederman's door. Next, Hyacinth can torture him with her sewing needles. Then, Lainey can suffocate him with kisses and hugs until he..."
"Let's just hope the first idea works, and he realizes how wonderful we are and begs us to stay,"
Issa interrupted.
Oliver grinned. "Too bad you're too nice. I could probably think of a way to get you in on the plan."
While Oliver and Issa discussed the Biederman mission, Hyacinth came downstairs with an armload of felt. She settled down on the living room carpet and busied herself cutting red felt circles for her hollyberry placemats. Franz looked on with his woeful basset hound eyes, then went to his food bowl and began the slow process of nudging it across the room until it banged into her knee. Hyacinth recognized the gravity of the situation immediately.
"Oh, my poor Franz! You must be starving!"
Franz looked at Hyacinth and forgave her at once. Hyacinth filled his bowl with precisely one scoop of dry dog food. The veterinarian had warned her against giving Franz more than that for fear he would get too heavy. Oliver, who had been beside her at the appointment, muttered, "Too late," under his breath, just loud enough for Hyacinth to hear. It was a particular gift of Oliver's that he could say things that adults couldn't hear, but his sisters could. Hyacinth was feeding Franz when a disheveled Jessie came downstairs with her signature bedhead, followed by Lainey wearing a glittery crown. "We're off," Jessie announced to Issa, Oliver, and Hyacinth as she wrangled Lainey into her puffy purple jacket and sparkly winter boots.
"Make sure to buy extra cheese croissants," Oliver said.
"Good idea," Jessie said as she grabbed a ragged scarf and wrapped it around her neck.
"All the better to persuade the Biederman with." "The extra cheese croissants were for me," Oliver clarified. "But I guess you can get some for the Biederman, too."
Jessie and Issa shared an eye roll. Then Jessie took Lainey's hand and led her outside, where they promptly bumped into Mr. Smiley, the superintendent at the big apartment building on their block, and his daughter Angie, who was friends with Oliver.
"Hello, Lainey. Hello, Jessie," Mr. Smiley said.
"Tell Oliver he owes me a basketball game,"
Angie said. Oliver and Angie were constantly challenging each other to one-on-one basketball games, and it had to be said that Angie was so good, the boys' basketball team begged her to play for them. Jessie and Lainey waved goodbye. They passed by the brownstone with the turrets, then the brownstone covered with ivy, then the brownstone where garlands of pine were draped all along the windows, and a huge wreath with a wavy burgundy bow decorated the heavy wooden door. They turned the corner onto the boulevard, where the quiet of their street gave way to city buses with their screeching brakes, and shop owners unlocking and rolling up the metal grates they had pulled down over their stores the night before. A garbage truck squealed to a stop down the street, and Mark, one of their neighborhood sanitation men, jumped off the back and tossed the contents of an overflowing trash bin into the hopper of the garbage truck.
"You're strong," Lainey called.
"I'm going to be strong one day, too."
Lainey pumped her arms to show her biceps. Mark laughed and said,
"Hey, I got a good joke for you, Lainey. What's red and white and red and white and red and white?"
Lainey tilted her head, considering.
"A candy cane?"
"That's one answer. But I'm thinking of something else," Mark said, grabbing hold of the end of the garbage truck once again.
The truck began to move.
"Tell me,"
yelled Lainey at the retreating truck. Mark bellowed the answer.
"Santa Claus, rolling down a hill."
Lainey giggled and waved as Mark saluted her from the back of the garbage truck. Down the avenue they went. They passed by Harlem Coffee with their long line of bleary-eyed customers, A to Z Deli, which was just opening up, then the library, still closed for another few hours. Once they passed the library, the sisters made a right at 137th Street. They smelled the delicious buttery sweetbread smells from Castleman's Bakery before they saw the storefront. Castleman's Bakery, home of the legendary cheese croissants, was right across from the entrance to City College. It had sat in that same location for decades and had a loyal following of people who would cross boroughs and state lines to buy bread and pastries there. The Vanderbeeker kids truly believed the Biederman would take one bite of the buttery but not greasy, flaky but not crumbly pastry and be won over at once. Mr. Castleman was the renowned neighborhood baker and his wife managed the front of the store. They had a son, Benny, an eighth grader at the twins' middle school and a close friend of Isa's. He worked as a cashier at the bakery on the weekends and some days after school. At his suggestion, his parents had recently purchased an electronic touchscreen register that had all the prices programmed in, along with a credit card machine, allowing customers to sign their name with their finger. Benny, however, was the only one who knew how to operate this register. Mrs. Castleman preferred to use the antique cash register that made a brisk ka-ching sound whenever the drawer opened.
"Hey, hey, what's up, Vanderbeekers?"
Benny called from behind the two registers with a wide grin. He wore a football jersey and blue jeans under his work apron. Jesse smiled at him, and Lainey ducked under the counter and wrapped her arms around his waist.
"Hello, Princess Lainey," Benny said, as Lainey adjusted the crown on her head.
"I have a joke for you," Lainey said.
"Tell me."
"Okay. What is Santa Claus rolling down a hill?"
"Wait, that's not it. I forgot."
Lainey's eyebrows were furrowed with confusion.
"What's red and white and..."
Jesse prompted.
"Oh, yeah. What's red and white and red and white and red and white?"
Benny tapped his chin with his index finger.
That's a tough one.
Lainey was gleeful.
"Do you give up? Should I tell you?"
"Tell me. I can't think of anything."
"Santa Claus rolling down a hill."
Benny chuckled.
"Oh, man, that is a good joke. I'm going to remember that one."
Benny picked Lainey up and sat her on the counter next to the register, then plucked a jam cookie from a wide-mouthed glass jar and handed it to her. Then he reached in again and retrieved one for Jessie, presenting it to her with a gallant bow.
"Thanks, Benny,"
Jessie said, taking a bite of the crumbly cookie. She had known him for so long that she forgot to call him Benjamin, the name he decided he wanted to be called the day he turned 10. Mrs. Castleman peered through round tortoiseshell spectacles over the glass case containing the breads and pastries, her gaze just barely skimming the top.
"The usual, yes?" she asked.
Jesse nodded.
"Also, I need 3 of your best breakfast goodies for our upstairs neighbor."
"How are Miss Josie and Mr. G doing?"
asked Mrs. Castleman.
"They're doing fine, but the pastries aren't for them. This time it's for our upstairs neighbor, Mr. Biederman."
Mrs. Castleman raised an eyebrow in surprise.
"Mr. Biederman?"
"He lives on the 3rd floor. We're trying to persuade him to like us." Jessie rummaged through her bag for her wallet.
"Mr. Biederman,"
Mrs. Castleman repeated softly while she leaned down to pluck pastries from the display case. Something in the way Mrs. Castleman said his name made Jessie stop. She bent down to peer through the glass case, but she could only see Mrs. Castleman's hand reaching out to retrieve the pastries.
"Do you know him, Mrs. Castleman?"
A pause. Jessie was about to ask yet again, louder, when Benny interrupted.
"So, Jessie, did you hear about the 8th grade dance?"
he asked casually, leaning his elbows on the counter. Lainey still sat next to the register, picking through the coins in the little cup that said, "Take a penny, leave a penny." Jessie glanced at Mrs. Castleman once more before turning back to Benny.
"No? What about it?"
Jessie said to Benny as she dug through her tote. Battered science notebook, a couple of pieces of candy and tired wrappers, scuffed calculator.
"Oh, there was her wallet."
"Well," Benny continued, "do you think your sister would want to go?" Jessie lifted her eyes to his.
"What sister?"
Benny stuck his hands deep into the pockets of his jeans.
"Esau? Your twin sister?"
"Esau? Go to an 8th grade dance?
Benny, she's a 7th grader. She can't go to an 8th grade dance."
"She can go with an 8th grader, which I am, and 8th grader, and I would ask her nicely, of course."
Do you think she would say yes? Benny began to shift from foot to foot. Lainey interrupted.
I like to dance,
she informed him, while handing him 2 pennies from the take-a-penny cup. Benny took the pennies from her and dropped them back into the cup. Meanwhile, Jessie's mind spun like the centrifuge she'd used in science class last month. Benny wanted to take her sister to a dance? Without her? They had never gone to a school dance without each other. They'd never gone to a dance with a date, ever. That would surely violate the rule of the twins. Somewhere in that unwritten contract, there must be a clause that clearly stated that neither was to attend a dance without the other, especially with a date. I am positive she wouldn't want to go with you, Benny. I'm sorry, Jessie said.
Not that you aren't great.
It's just that I definitely think no. Benny's face fell.
Why not?
Jessie started to feel a little bad for him. It's nothing against you. I just can't imagine her saying yes. She opened her wallet and pulled out some money.
I like to dance,
Lainey repeated as she took another penny from the cup and tried to scrub it clean with the hem of her jacket. Benny didn't respond to either sister. He carefully rang up Jessie's order on the cash register, took her money, then handed her the change. Thanks, Benny, Jessie said, grabbing the bags of croissants and the goodies for Mr. Biederman. Benny lifted Lainey down from the counter, and she ducked back under and took Jessie's hand. See you around, said Jessie with a brief wave. Bye, Mrs. Castleman. The two sisters left the bakery, while Benny and his mother watched them disappear from view. Mrs. Castleman wisely stepped into the back room where her husband was twisting and kneading bread, leaving her son alone with his thoughts. Chapter 6 The moment Jessie left the bakery, all thoughts of dances and Benny and the rule of the twins vanished. Lainey, who carried the Biederman's bag of pastries, surreptitiously peeked into the brown bag while they were walking home. The sugary, spicy smell of the apple turnover almost made her dizzy. She wondered if the Biederman would mind if she took that one for herself. Don't even think about it, Jessie said, reaching down to cup Lainey's chin. Lainey puffed out her cheeks and rolled the top of the bag closed. Issa, Hyacinth, and Oliver were waiting in the kitchen when Jessie and Lainey returned home. Quick! We sent Mama and Papa upstairs and told them we would bring them breakfast in bed. They looked so pleased they didn't even ask any questions, said Issa, her face flushed. Hyacinth had taken out her special tea tray and tea things to use for the Biederman's breakfast. The tray was faded but still pretty, with a big rainbow in the middle and 3 cherubs with harps floating above it. Her china teapot only had 2 chips, and she had folded a piece of red checkered fabric for a napkin and laid it on the side of the tray. The kids transferred the remains from the morning's coffee pot into the teapot. Then Oliver dumped 3 generous spoonfuls of sugar into it, and Issa added milk. After Jessie stirred it, Issa placed the teapot on the tray, and Hyacinth artfully arranged the pastries from Lainey's bag. To their knowledge, the Biederman had never experienced the joy of breakfast in bed, and they were certain that Oliver's excellent idea would win him over. Ready? Jessie asked Lainey.
Ready, ready,
Lainey chirruped. The Vanderbeekers went upstairs, crept past Mama and Papa's bedroom, then opened the door that led to the first floor hallway. Be careful, Issa whispered. Break a leg, Oliver whispered. Hyacinth didn't say anything. She just bit her lip and looked worried. They watched as Jessie and Lainey went up the stairs. The scent of laundry soap, old books, and double chocolate pecan cookies from the Vanderbeekers' floor gave way to the smell of Miss Josie's Southern Rose perfume on the 2nd floor. The stairs leading to the 3rd floor groaned all the way up, and the air turned musty and stale, as if the brownstone were warning them away. Jessie took a deep breath and prepared to knock. Before she could exhale, Lainey pounded her two fists on the door.
Lainey!
Jessie tried to balance the tray while preventing Lainey from attacking the door again. The teapot shivered and slid to the edge of the tray. Jessie lifted up a knee to prop up the tray, but overcompensated.
Fudge!
Jessie blurted out as the teapot slid to the other side of the tray, tipped off the side, and shattered on the ground. The three pastries fell on top of it.
Fudge, fudge, fudge!
Jessie cast a look at the door. The peephole was a collection of circles getting smaller and smaller, converging on a dark round circle in the middle. Then, the circle blinked.
Oh, fudge!
This time Jessie's expletive was quite a bit louder. She scooped Lainey up and crashed down the stairs. The destroyed breakfast left abandoned outside the Biederman's door. Issa, Hyacinth, and Oliver were waiting by the first floor doorway when they heard Jessie's yelling, followed by a terrific crash. Seconds later, they saw Jessie and Lainey barreling down the stairs. When Issa saw the terror on Jessie's face, she did not stop to ask questions. Issa swung open the door to their apartment, and together the five Vanderbeekers scrambled inside and let the door slam behind them.
Complete fail,
Jessie wheezed, her back against the hallway wall.
Shh,
said Issa, pointing a finger at Mama and Papa's room. The kids tiptoed to Issa and Jessie's room and shut the door.
What happened?
Asked Issa the moment the door closed. Jessie was frantic.
I lost control of the tray and everything fell. I'm sorry, Hyacinth, I broke your teapot.
Hyacinth looked back at Jessie with wide eyes.
After I dropped the breakfast, I looked up at the door and I saw his evil eye blink at me through the peephole, and it was like he was cursing me with 1,000 curses. I didn't think. I should have stayed there and cleaned up or tried to explain him or something. I'm sorry, I screwed up,
Jessie babbled.
Okay, okay, it's okay. I'll clean it up, don't worry,
Issa said, pulling Jessie into a hug.
I'll help,
Hyacinth said. Me too, Oliver offered. Lainey was put in charge of soothing Jessie's wounded soul by feeding her cheese croissants, while Issa, Hyacinth, and Oliver gathered cleaning supplies and a garbage bag and went upstairs. Tears dripped from Hyacinth's eyes as she gathered the remains of her beloved teapot and put them in the garbage bag. Oliver mopped up the spill with paper towels and mourned the ruined soggy pastries. Issa did a final mop to get rid of the stickiness, careful to keep her eyes averted from the peephole. They slinked down the stairs, each one thinking that this was a huge setback to Operation Biederman. While Issa, Oliver, and Hyacinth were cleaning up, Jessie and Lainey delivered croissants to their parents. Lainey went over to Papa's side of the bed and snuggled next to him as he scrolled through his phone reviewing job tickets, which Lainey knew meant all the computer problems people wanted Papa to fix, like when someone spilled coffee on their keyboard, or when the computer showed only a black screen, no matter how many buttons you pushed. Mama looked up from her own phone when Jessie stood by her bed. Mama had been clicking through a realtor website.
Everything okay?
Mama asked, setting her phone on the bedside table. Jessie shrugged and handed over the bag of croissants.
Talk to me,
her mom said, beckoning Jessie to sit on the bed. Jessie perched on the side. This whole moving thing sucks big time. Mama nodded and wrapped an arm around her.
This place has so many memories.
Mama looked at the wall, where 6 years ago, an unsupervised 3-year-old Oliver had drawn a post-impressionistic Picasso-like depiction of their family. The miraculous thing about the artwork was that Oliver had drawn not just himself, Jessie with her signature wild scientist hair, Issa with her typical smooth ponytail, and his parents, but also yet-to-be-born Hyacinth and Lainey.
I feel like we need to cut out that part of the wall and bring it with us to our new home,
Mama said. Uncle Arthur could do it, Jessie suggested.
I don't think the Biederman, I mean, Mr. Biederman, would appreciate us gouging a hole in his wall.
Mama continued to look at the drawing. Then, to Jessie's horror, she saw a tear roll down Mama's face.
Oh, Mama, don't cry, Jessie said, even as she felt the burning of her own eyes.
Sweetie, don't worry about me.
Mama brushed her tear away and gave Jessie a brave smile.
Just being sentimental.
Jessie's throat constricted. She wanted to rewind the last hour and do it all over again. In her mind, she saw herself handling the tray with elegance and poise, presenting it to a grateful Biederman who accepted it with a smile. He would be so relieved to have real food after all those years of frozen dinners. With his first bite of cheese croissant, his eyes would light up, and he would announce that the Vanderbeekers could stay in their apartment forever. If only the reimagined story could be reality.
Chapter 7.
The mood was somber by the time the five Vanderbeeker kids gathered back downstairs to eat their own breakfast. Hyacinth felt responsible for the failed outreach as she watched Jessie mope. After all, Jessie had wanted Hyacinth to do the first Biederman mission. Now Hyacinth needed to fix it. Directly after breakfast, Hyacinth retreated to her room with Franz. While her dog occupied himself by staring out the window at a bird, Hyacinth took out sewing supplies and sheets of red and green felt. Carefully, she cut out letters spelling the Biederman's name from the green felt. Then she threaded her needle and sewed the letters onto the rectangular red piece. The letters did not end up going across the placemat in a straight line. Instead, four letters in, she realized that there was a distinct upward slant. She tried to correct it with the next few letters, but when she reached the M, the name was tilting the opposite direction. By the time she finished, the name had a decidedly bumpy look about it, and something else seemed off. She thought that the I was before the E, but after she sewed the letters on, it looked a little wrong. Hyacinth's hand was aching by the time she finished. She rolled the placemat up and tied a green velvet ribbon around it. She let her eyes linger on the green ribbon, already mourning the loss of that piece from her collection. It was not easy to part with her beautiful things.
"You ready to be brave, Franz?"
asked Hyacinth. Franz lifted his front legs and rested them against her stomach. It was time for Hyacinth to be more than just the fourth Vanderbeeker, the shy one, the scared one. She needed to be Hyacinth the Brave, a girl on a mission to save her home. Together, Hyacinth the Brave and Franz left their apartment and marched upstairs. The brownstone stairs whimpered all the way up.
"Be brave, be brave, be brave," Hyacinth whispered to herself.
She looked down at Franz, and her faithful dog grinned at her and wagged his tail. Hyacinth squared her shoulders and knocked on the door. The second Hyacinth knocked, she knew something bad was going to happen. She knew before she heard the stomping from inside the third-floor apartment and the barrage of clicks and bangs from locks being disengaged. She knew even before the door swung open. Hyacinth trembled as she stood before a monster of a man with shaggy dark hair and a beard streaked with white. His face was creased and pale and lifeless. He was wearing black, black, black.
"Leave me alone!"
His voice shocked Hyacinth. It sounded like he was talking around a mouthful of nails.
"Move out of here and let me be!"
Hyacinth stood frozen for a full second. No longer was she Hyacinth the Brave. She was back to being the fourth Vanderbeeker, first-class worrier, and the shyest kid on 141st Street. She dropped the placemat at his feet and stumbled down the stairs, Franz at her heels. She reached the door to their apartment and slammed the door behind her. When she reached the safety of her top bunk, she burst into tears, big, hiccuping, drowning tears. Oliver's stomach was rumbling when he heard the door down the hall from his bedroom slam, and then his little sister's bedroom door open and shut. For a millisecond, he wondered if everything was okay. When he didn't hear anything else, he put his book aside and decided to search the kitchen to see if he could find where his mom was hiding the double chocolate pecan cookies. He opened his bedroom door. Oliver heard sobbing. It sounded like Hyacinth. He tried to ignore it. The cookies were calling him. But then the sobbing intensified. Oliver knocked on Hyacinth and Lainey's bedroom door. There was no answer. He opened the door and peeked inside. Franz sat on the carpet, whimpering. Hyacinth lay on her top bunk, her stuffed penguin held close to her chest. Oliver let himself in and closed the door behind him.
"Can I come up?"
There was no answer except suppressed sobs, so Oliver took that as a yes and climbed to the top bunk. Hyacinth was a sad sight, with her blotchy face and swollen eyes.
"Everything okay?"
Oliver asked. No answer. He tried again.
"Want to tell me what's wrong?"
"Nothing."
"Do I need to get my sword and take someone down?"
Hyacinth sobbed out something through her tears that sounded like Miss Bibi Mania, which Oliver was certain could not be correct. He gingerly patted Hyacinth's back and waited for her to be more coherent.
"I felt like I needed to fix what happened this morning with breakfast. Well, I spent hours making him a placemat, and then I brought it upstairs to him, and I thought I was Hyacinth the Brave, but he was the scariest man I've ever seen."
Hyacinth's eyes brimmed with fresh tears. Oliver scowled, then rolled his shoulders and neck. "I'm going to challenge him to a pirate duel." Oliver demonstrated his hand swipe technique. "Take that, Biederman." Hyacinth looked at Oliver with watery eyes.
"After I defeat him with my superior pirate skills, we could let Franz loose and have him pee all over his door again. Would that make you feel better?"
Franz's tail thumped once against the carpet.
"I don't know why he hates us so much," Hyacinth said with a wail.
Oliver deflated.
"Maybe it's best that we move. At least we'll get away from him."
Hyacinth shook her head sadly.
"I love it here. I want things to go back to how they were before. Before we had to be nice to him."
Her eyes began to well up. Oliver, alarmed by the prospect of Hyacinth crying again, suggested that they go downstairs so she could show him her collection of buttons. It was an activity that never failed to cheer her up, even though it bored Oliver to no end. As they went down the stairs to the living room, Oliver remembered something.
"Hey, Hyacinth."
"Yeah?"
"What did the Biederman look like, anyway?"
Hyacinth paused to think.
"Do you remember the movie Uncle Arthur took us to last year? The one where the werewolf creeps out of the cave to attack the unicorn?"
"Yeah."
"The Biederman looked like the werewolf."
"Wow,"
Oliver said as he let out the breath he didn't know he was holding.
"Cool."
While Oliver was trying to make Hyacinth feel better, Lainey received permission from Mama to bring Paganini the bunny upstairs to Miss Josie and Mr. Jeet's place. Lainey loved visiting them for many reasons. Number one, Miss Josie made the best jam cookies with plenty of strawberry jam in the middle, and she never, ever used orange marmalade. Number two, Mr. Jeet always knew what she was saying. He didn't do that awful grown-up thing where he looked at her parents or siblings to translate what she had said. Number three, Miss Josie was a terrific dancer, and she was teaching Lainey how to Lindy hop. Number 4. Going into their apartment was like entering an enchanted garden, and Miss Josie let Lainey pick flowers anytime she wanted. Mama and Papa had told Lainey that Mr. Jeet had had a stroke 2 years ago, which meant that he sounded and looked a little different than he used to. But that never bothered Lainey. He had always been the same to her, and she loved the way he talked nice and slow so she could understand all the words. Issa and Jesse and Oliver told stories about how Mr. Jeet used to give them endless piggyback rides. He would play horsey and sleeping bear and friendly dragon. Lainey didn't remember that, but it didn't matter. Mr. Jeet was perfect in every way. Lainey lured Paganini into his carrier with a few bits of carrot, then took her time climbing up to the second floor. A few months earlier, she had stumbled going up the stairs and almost fell on Paganini and squashed him, and Lainey did not want that to happen again. She made it upstairs without tripping, set the carrier down, and attempted many unsuccessful jumps to reach the doorbell. By her fifth jump, the doors swung open, and a smiling Miss Josie appeared. Miss Josie had curlers in her hair and fuzzy slippers on her feet. She greeted Lainey with a big hug.
"Hello, my beautiful Lainey. Come in and have some tea and cookies with Mr. Jeet and me."
Lainey brushed past a large fern and skipped over to Mr. Jeet and climbed into his lap. Mr. Jeet was immaculately dressed in a pressed button-down shirt and crisp black trousers. A large daisy was stuck into his shirt pocket, and a purple bow tie with very thin white stripes lay against his throat.
"Your bow tie is very nice,"
Lainey commented, followed by, "Does the Biederman like cheese croissants?"
"Cheese croissants?"
Mr. Jeet repeated as he removed the daisy from his pocket and handed it to Lainey.
"I don't know."
He looked at Miss Josie.
"Did you ever meet him?"
pressed Lainey. She took a deep whiff of the daisy before sticking it behind her ear. Miss Josie looked uncomfortable.
"I knew him back before. Well, never mind that. I remember he used to listen to a lot of music. He had a record player, like us. He loved jazz music."
"I like jazz music," said Lainey.
Miss Josie leaned down and kissed Lainey's forehead.
"Me too," she said.
Mr. Jeet tugged on one of Lainey's braids.
"Is Paganini with you?"
"He's here."
Lainey slid off Mr. Jeet's lap and got the carrier. She unzipped it, and the tip of Paganini's nose emerged. Miss Josie gave Mr. Jeet a sprig of cilantro, and Paganini's rabbit nose led the way over to the delicious herb, where he plucked it from Mr. Jeet's hands and ate it with both efficiency and speed. Mr. Jeet grinned, his smile lopsided.
"You should train him," Mr. Jeet said. "Do tricks."
Lainey giggled.
"Paganini? Do tricks? That's so funny, Mr. Jeet."
Mr. Jeet looked at her with a serious face.
"It would be fun."
Lainey realized that Mr. Jeet was not joking. She imagined her family looking at her in amazement when they saw Paganini do tricks. Then she added a spotlight and a stage and lots of clapping to her imagination. Lainey looked at Mr. Jeet with more interest.
"What kind of tricks?"
Mr. Jeet pulled out another sprig of cilantro and said,
"Paganini, come."
The bunny was busy rooting around in a corner behind a ficus plant and paid Mr. Jeet no attention. Mr. Jeet gestured to Lainey, and she walked across the room and picked up Paganini and turned him around. Mr. Jeet repeated the command, waving the cilantro. Paganini hopped over right away at the smell of the cilantro and gobbled it up, his back molars crunching away happily. And so the training began. Mr. Jeet instructed Miss Josie to chop a carrot into little bits. These would serve as Paganini's training tools. Together, Mr. Jeet and Lainey worked on come, rewarding Paganini with one small piece of carrot every time he successfully completed the command. It was decided that Lainey would visit with Paganini every day for training. Big plans were made for a bunny show after Christmas Eve dinner.
"Can I wear a sparkly dress?" asked Lainey. "And shoes with heels that tap like Mama's shoes?"
Mr. Jeet nodded.
"Paganini can wear a bow tie. I'll lend him one."
As Lainey put Paganini back in the carrier, she turned to Miss Josie and Mr. Jeet.
"Did you know we're moving?" she asked.
Miss Josie went silent, and Mr. Jeet looked away.
"We know," Miss Josie finally said. "Yo papa told us."
"I don't want to move. Will you still live upstairs?"
"Sweetie, I don't think we can move with you," Miss Josie replied. "We're too old to make a big move like that."
"I have an idea. I can help you move. I can carry things downstairs," Lainey suggested.
"How about we see what happens? But if we can't come with you, we'll visit you and you can visit us."
Miss Josie's voice wobbled and Mr. Jeet's head bowed lower, tears rolling down his cheeks and splashing onto his pants. Miss Josie walked Lainey and Paganini to the door and watched them descend the staircase to the first floor and safely enter their apartment. Miss Josie closed her own door, then went to her husband and kissed his head.
"It'll be okay. We'll be okay," she whispered to him,
even as her own tears betrayed her. Chapter 8. After a lunch of grab whatever you can from the fridge, followed by an hour of reading a massive science encyclopedia she had dragged home from the library, Jessie needed a break. She took the stairs two at a time to the bedroom in search of Isa. When she opened the door, she found Allegra, their friend from school, standing in the middle of the room wearing a frightful dress that made her look like a giant boysenberry. A bunch of other equally hideous garments were laid out on Isa's bed. Jessie shielded her eyes and grimaced.
"I'm blind. Too much tools disguised as clothes."
Allegra harumphed.
"Jess, get a grip. It's not like I'm going to wear this when I walk the dog."
Allegra gave a regal spin that looked like a move she learned from a terrible girly girl movie.
"This is what you wear for an eighth grade semi-formal dance." "I think Allegra looks lovely,"
Isa said, gazing at Allegra reverently.
"Isn't that amazing that she's going to the eighth grade dance?"
Jessie grunted.
"I guess."
She slumped into the beanbag chair. Allegra looked thoughtfully at Jessie.
"Jess, listen up. You could look so gorgeous if you wore something other than those old jeans and sweatshirts. I bet if you dressed a little nicer and maybe used some farewell frizz spray or something to smooth down your hair, an eighth grader would invite you to the dance, too."
Jessie rolled her eyes to the ceiling.
"And that, my friend, is why I'm not going to dress differently. Eighth grade boys think they are so cool. A dance sounds like torture."
Jessie looked at Isa for affirmation, but her sister wasn't paying attention. Isa fingered one of the dresses on the bed.
"Hey, can I try this one?"
She held up the least abominable of the dresses, a floor-length sleeveless peach-colored dress that had a high waist and fell in soft folds to the ground.
"Sure," Allegra said. "Jess, feel free to try anything on. That sparkly blue one would look so awesome on you."
"Never going to happen,"
Jessie replied as she picked at her cuticles. The sparkly blue dress looked like something a 6-year-old would wear to an ice skating competition.
"Jess, help me," Isa said.
Jessie got up and helped Isa gently pull the dress down over her head. Jessie smoothed the long skirt and zipped up the back. Isa turned around.
"Wow,"
Jesse breathed. You look like a queen. An awesome kick-butt queen.
Allegra clasped her hands to her chest. That dress is so amazing on you, she squealed.